milligrams is enough to noticeably lower the blood sugar when it's interfered with by free fatty acids.
So when it lowers the free fatty acids, where does it put it? Does it put it back into the tissue, or where does it go?
Oh, no, it just stays in your fat cells.
Oh, okay. I had one other question. It's about bag breathing. Is there an upper limit to how many times per day you could bag breathe to restore the CO2 levels if you had an exercise-intensive lifestyle?
I don't know about the exercise, but I've known people who did it several times a day who got their blood pressure down 30 or 40 points in a day or two.
Okay, that's great. Thanks for everything.
Okay, thanks for your call, caller. Okay, Dr. P, I think there could be another caller who's just called in. Is that right? Yeah, caller, I think you're on the air. And where are you from?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, you're on the air. Where are you from?
Eureka.
Eureka,
oops.
Okay.
Yeah. I think you're on the air. I just turned my radio back on.
Yeah, turn it off.
When you were talking about the blood here, breathing in the bag, that popped my ears open. And so here's my story is my wife's got breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it has settled into the marrow. After she had a mastectomy a year and a half ago, it's come back and now is in the marrow. So she's constantly needing platelets.
Yeah.
And red blood.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were talking about this breathing in a bag, or even in general, do you have any ideas of how to keep the blood, the red blood cells up, or her platelets up?
Dr. P.
Oh, I don't think the CO2 in the bag would, necessarily help that unless she's tending to hyperventilate. Has she been having her estrogen measured?
I don't think that's they've done that, no.
That's one of the possible causes. Estrogen, in the normal situation, any female animal has a lower red blood cell count, partly just because estrogen slows the activity of the marrow. And so it's one of the things that should be checked if there's an underactive marrow involved. And
at this point, she gets platelets, you know, almost every 2 days, 2-3 days. She's been getting this shot called N plate. And that might be starting to help because now her numbers have been staying up a little bit, but for 2 months now, 2-3 months ever since January when she went in the hospital, she's out now, but, they've been having to give her, platelets and blood and all this stuff. And
Dr. Pete, what are the things that you, would look towards, suggesting for help? That would be nutritional and or diet, you know, dietary advice that would be useful for that kind of a situation?
Copper is one of the nutrients that's often deficient in marrow problems. So having some seafood, crustaceans, crab, and so on,
mm-hmm.
are rich in copper.
Okay.
And, a liver is a good source.
Liver?
Liver, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, you're welcome. I think we have another caller on the air. Hi, caller, you're on the air, and where are you from?
Yeah, I'm a local fella. It's a very interesting, and I'd like to get some references. Where can I go to learn more about this?
Well, Dr. P, I'm sure you've been reading for the last 40 years, but Dr. Pete's website, he doesn't sell anything, but he has lots of articles. He produces a newsletter, and it's pretty altruistic. So his website is www.raypete.com. And there's lots of articles there that are fully referenced, scientific journal articles that are from published trials and published scientific papers. So his website is a very good source of information that will be sometimes a little hard to read, though. I'll just warn you about that.
Okay.
It's fairly academic, but there's lots of common sense woven in between of it as well. So it's a very good starting place to start educating yourself.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Yeah. Okay. I think there was another caller on the air. No. Okay. Okay. The caller's gone. Okay. Dr. Pete, I got another question for you, and it's about cholesterol. I know you've mentioned in the past that the free form of cholesterol is good, and the esterified form is destructive, particularly with reference to Alzheimer's and what goes on in the brain of the Alzheimer's patient. But what causes this cholesterol to become esterified, and how is myelin, which comprises the nerve sheath and so important to proper nerve signaling, made?
Sugar and thyroid and progesterone are often the limiting factors in making myelin fast enough. And sugar in the system in general helps you make cholesterol. Keeping the energy up is necessary to make enough cholesterol. And the cholesterol is a stabilizing factor for every aspect of the cell division, multiplication, ion regulation, and so on. And it happens that the myelin is especially rich in cholesterol. But apparently stress activates enzymes that attach fatty acids to the cholesterol as possibly some kind of adaptive reaction for changing the rate of cholesterol synthesis, maybe. But anyway, estrogen is one of the factors that promotes the combination with fatty acids. Mm. And the fact that so few animals are given a diet low in unsaturated fats, that has influenced the research on trying to explain what the ester form of the cholesterol means. Because when we find it, for example, if you look at an atheroma in a hardening artery, as it begins to form, there's only a little of the ester form of cholesterol. But as it ages and advances and becomes more destructive to the artery, the concentration of linoleic acid attached to the cholesterol increases progressively with deterioration and aging. And the research just hasn't been interested in looking at animals that are deprived of unsaturated fats to see if they would even form the atherosclerotic plaque at all.
Right.
Many of the degenerative changes are extremely delayed when animals are made deficient, so-called, mm-hmm. in the so-called essential fatty acids. For example, in relation to diabetes, several experimenters have created a technical deficiency of essential fatty acids by giving them a diet containing almost no linoleic or arachidonic acid. And then they poison them with the standard chemicals for creating diabetes, and they're essentially impervious. They just refuse to get diabetes in the usual conditions. Their pancreas is so resistant.
Okay, excellent. We've got another caller on the air, and so let's take this next caller.
This was a question from a caller. She was wondering about the dose needed to lower stress of pregnenolone.
Pregnenolone. Okay, an engineer, if anyone calls in and wants it off the air, if you could just find out where they are from.
Oh, okay,
that'd be useful.
I think she's local.
Oh, okay. All right, so the dose of progesterone?
Of pregnenolone, I've seen a couple people who were severely stressed, having depression, anxiety symptoms and such, with just 15 or 20 milligrams, I've seen a total change in just 10 or 15 minutes. But other people who were looking for improved tone of their skin, their face was drooping or something, didn't see any effect when they took 100 or 200 milligrams. But sometimes if they take 1,000 or 2,000 milligrams, they'll get a sudden visible change in their appearance, look less stressed. But normally a full day's supply would be 30 to 50 milligrams.
Right. Talking about pregnenolone a little more, do you think, well, I would think it's probably a fairly obvious thing to ask, but are people are variably sensitive or insensitive to anything, and that would include pregnenolone as a in relation to whether or not they respond to it at a low dose or whether they need a high dose?
Well, I've seen very few people under the age of 45 who could feel any amount that they took. If you're healthy and young, you don't need it.
Right.
But in animal experiments, they found that if you had a bunch of 20 rats and two or three of them were, for some reason, under stress and had high stress hormones, and then they gave them a stomach tube feeding of a heaping teaspoon or so, filled their stomach so that they couldn't take any more. The only effect they saw on their hormones was in the stressed individuals, and their stress hormones went to normal, where they couldn't see any hormonal effect in the unstressed animals, even with gigantic, the equivalent to something like a pint of powdered progesterone in one meal.
Okay. All right, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM. And until the close of the show at 8 o'clock or 5 to 8, you're invited to call in with any questions related or unrelated to this month's subject of restoring nerve tissue and getting into shock at this point. So, Dr. Pete, getting back to, well, let's let people know, it's 1-800-KMUD-RAD. Okay, sorry, I almost slipped up on that. So getting back to stress and endotoxin, and we've mentioned endotoxin, or rather you've described the process by which endotoxin affects the body. Now, endotoxin is generally produced in the gut.
Under mild stress, a person often reduces their circulation to their intestine. If you listen to your belly with a stethoscope, when you're having relaxed, happy thoughts, you can hear a constant churning sound.
Right.
But if you think of something anxiety-provoking, things go quiet. And that's because adrenaline or the sympathetic nervous system shuts things down, and it even shuts down the circulation to some extent. And if that persists for very long, it starts weakening the cells, and there's always some endotoxin churning around in the food bacteria mixture. And if the intestine becomes weakened for some reason, could be traumatic injury, or it could just be chronic anxiety, decreasing the energy of your intestine to form a barrier. So as the barrier is weakened, then it gets into your, first it passes into the liver and tends to fatigue the liver, deplete energy, but there's often some of it circulating chronically in the bloodstream. Chronic anxiety people and fat people in particular tend to have an elevated chronic level circulating.
Okay, so how I read that from an article that the endotoxin, stress and endotoxin induced an increase in the brain's concentration of tryptophan and serotonin. Now, both of these I know from what we've talked about over these shows, tryptophan and serotonin are both very inflammatory and not something that you would want to promote in any way. And we've talked about things that block tryptophan and serotonin. So,
and histamine tends to go along with that increase. And anything that stresses you, that lowers your blood sugar, is likely to release histamine and serotonin improperly.
Okay.
And coffee happens to be one of the things that will protect you against serotonin and histamine. And the famous oldest antihistamines was periactin or ciproheptadine.
Okay.
And it blocks both histamine and serotonin. And people who are very allergic sometimes have to carry an adrenaline pen in case they get stung by a bee, if they're allergic to bees, or if they eat a peanut or whatever that they're allergic to.
Mm-hmm.
And the combination of sugar and caffeine, some people have found that if they have a Coke handy, which mm-hmm. contains both caffeine and sugar,
mm-hmm.
They don't need their adrenaline pen.
Huh. That's an interesting question, actually. I would just start, and I do think about it, just because we have a little baby now, and she's out in the garden, and the garden's full of flowers, and of course she's looking at the bees, and we're making these bee sounds, and she's really very interested. And I've often thought to myself, my goodness, if she got stung and she had an anaphylactic reaction to it, what would be the fastest thing we could do, apart from, I definitely wouldn't be rushing her off to a hospital, because that's not really, it's not to a very local thing here. In terms of anything, steroidal anti-inflammatories, I mean, not to promote things that asthmatics use, but what would be a good way, if you, because babies, you can't just stuff sugar in the mouth, because they're not going to take it.
I knew a dentist who always on the shelf next to the operating chair, he had a little jar of instant tea and honey.
Instant tea?
When a patient would go into shock, he would mix them up a cup of very sweet, strong tea and have them sip that.
Okay, we have another caller, so let's not. Okay, caller, you're on the air, and where are you from? Oh, engineer's raising his hands as if the caller's not there. So, not on the air, okay. All right, well, we are getting close to the top of the hour anyway. But, okay, so that's an interesting. Do you think... Is there anything that you know that can be inhaled that may be quick enough in an anaphylactic situation where there is, danger of suffocation, or the airways are closing rapidly, rather than injecting? If you didn't have anything injectable like adrenaline to break that.
If you had some micro pulverized hydrocortisone.
Well, okay, yeah.
That's proven effective.
Right.
Had you known of other inhalants?
Well, no, because generally we don't, it's not something, babies we come across them very rarely, and it's only because we have one of our own now that I'm even thinking about it, because normally you can reason with an adult, and they can take things and swallow things and do things to help themselves because they recognize the danger of it, so I haven't really looked into it with that.
I know someone whose dog had been serious, well, both a dog and a goat had been seriously injured, and in both cases they put a big mouthful of honey into their mouth and held their mouth shut.
Okay. And go on.
In just a few minutes, they were up and out of shock.
Okay, because you're saying the energy that is obtained by consuming that sugar is also responsible for suppressing the inflammatory processes that would cause airways collapse.
There have been publications on using intravenous glucose, but as long as the person is conscious and can swallow it all,
Yeah.
It works orally. And glucagon, which is injected, it raises your blood sugar and is used often to treat shock.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, it's 5 to 8 o'clock now, so I should probably call that a good night. And thank you so much for your time and being on the show again, Dr. Pete. We really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. So for people that have tuned into the show, thank you for calling. And for those people who haven't called but have just listened, I hope you enjoyed the show. Dr. Pete is a wealth of information. Like I said, he doesn't sell anything. And his work is pretty extraordinary. So lots of what he's been talking about over the 5, 6, 7 years even that we've known him now, we're seeing borne out in people that are consulting for help and recommendations. So it's all stuff that we've actually seen ourselves. And his website's a very good source of scientifically referenced material that explains his rationale for the sometimes controversial things that he might say, especially surrounding saturated fats and sugar and salt and all those things that we get told are bad are actually very good for us and very helpful. So his website is www.raypete.com. And for those who've listened to the show and would like to contact us anytime Monday through Friday, we have an 800 number, which is 1-888. It's not an 800, it's an 888 number. Sorry, it's 1-888-WBM-HERB. So here we are in the end of, or the middle of April. Things are warming up now. I hope you are enjoying the show. And the third Friday of next month will be the next time that we're on the air. So thanks for your time and good night.